you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Jay Dyer back on the show. Jay, of course, is the proprietor of Jay's Analysis, jaysanalysis.com. He's the author of Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Film. You can purchase that book from his website, and he'll send you a signed copy. You're still doing that, Jay?
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah, go to his website, support his work by buying his book, buying for friends and family for holidays, for some of your... Is your more gullible, perhaps incredulous family members? Can you read the book?
Absolutely, yes. In fact, I've been selling quite a few for the upcoming holidays. So
excellent.
Still selling strong.
Excellent. And you're also the co-host of Hollywood Decoded with Jay Widener. Mm-hmm. And is that series run for the season now?
No, there's 23 full episodes, and I think we've aired 15, 16, somewhere in there. We did a couple Christopher Nolan films in the last few weeks, and then the most recent episode is Star Wars.
Okay, excellent. Okay, and I've just recently you've started sort of a consulting service for people.
I have. I've done quite a few private tutoring sessions, consulting, however we want to term it. And had about 10 people so far, and everybody's been really happy with that. So it's kind of self-directed study that deals with either philosophy or geopolitics or theology, whatever anybody's interest might be. I've even helped some people make some curriculums for homeschooling or stuff like that. So absolutely.
And that type of, education or consulting, I think is an excellent model for taking on the current, the establishment, the New World Order, if you will, of
right.
Of the sort of the institutional educational systems, whether it's university, high school. These, I guess, your level is probably more of a university level, I imagine, right?
Most of the people I've had probably graduate to undergraduate level questions, but okay. Yes, some of them have been like high school level curricula.
Okay, so you more just apply it to whoever's, inquires about your services?
Exactly.
Oh, okay, excellent. And they just send you an email or something? If they're interested?
Yeah, you can just email me for that personally. There's also, most people have just done it personally because they either don't have Patreon or don't want to use it. But if you just want to do it the easy way, you can just sign up on my Patreon page, which is available at Jay's Analysis.
Excellent. Okay, that's an excellent opportunity for people out there. to get deeper into some of these topics if you're interested in the things you cover.
Yeah, and also the what was I going to say? I've got a bit of a head cold, so I'm a little under the weather. So just bear with me. But there was something I was going to say about doing that, but I've already forgotten. So we can just move on.
Okay. Well, tonight you've done a number of top talks lately, excellent talks. One is you have this Globalist book series. And recent ones, you've done H.G. Wells, The Open Conspiracy, Arthur Koestler, The Ghost in the Machine. And, of course, I just had a chance to listen to your the one on Jonas Salk. What was the name of his book again?
Survival of the Wisest.
Survival of the Wisest. Interesting. Okay. And you also had a really interesting longer talk where you talked about cults, Hollywood, espionage, and large-scale social engineering. Perhaps it was inspired by some recent events. And you, in that one, you talked a wide variety of topics here and more or less the big picture. So first, this Globalist book series, H.G. Wells, The Open Conspiracy, Arthur Koestler, The Ghost in the Machine, and the Survival of the Wisest by the venerable Jonas Salk. So how do you want to get into that? Get into these things.
Well, this follows in the series that you could probably link to doing Tragedy and Hope last year or a year and a half ago, whenever it was. And from there, we followed up with Brzezinski's books earlier this year. And then we looked into subsequent Carol Quigley books, The Anglo-American Establishment, which we covered. And then we moved, as you said, to Bertrand Russell. And then to H.G. Wells. And Wells is, of course, situated in the midst of this priest class of Fabians and world socialists. And there is, I guess, some question as to how far into the plan H.G. Wells was really inducted, or was he a true believer? Did he really believe this propaganda? And John Adams and I were having a conversation a while back about that. And I think John's probably correct that it looks like Wells was probably not the most inner party guy, but was definitely a true believer in the Anglo-American Fabian socialist Marxist Zionist creation of the idea of a global federation. Really, I see all of these movements springing kind of from the same source of the banking power. And the banking power, wants to utilize technology, techne, as its central mode and means of bringing in this global order and global control. And so what's interesting is that we're actually moving into that phase that they planned back. You can even go back to the 1840s and 50s with the Galtons and that family, and even further back to Malthus. The whole idea of Malthusianism and what's interesting, if we step back a little bit further beyond Wells to Malthus, if you look at his sermons and essays, he was an Anglican minister. He projected on the basis of quantification a bunch of hoodoo Al Gore type scammery of the idea that there would not be enough food to feed the population if the population continued to rise. So in a way, Malthus was kind of the forerunner of he was the Al Gore of his day, you might say. And so you get this idea of battle for resources, that mankind is really only existing to compete for resources in a very strict survival of the fittest mode. It's not accidental that at the same time Malthus in the 1700s, you have the rise of, prior to that, the Adam Smith, David Ricardo liberal economic theory, which is also predicated on the notion of total competition, social Darwinism. We eventually get the character, of course, of Charles Darwin, which suspiciously does not invent the idea of evolution. He repackages it into a naturalistic form. So Herbert Spencer and plenty of ancient Greeks and ancient Egyptians and ancient Hindus had, of course, formulated this notion of aeons of transmutation of species, but it's really Darwin who pioneers the naturalistic ideas, as well as certain other ideas that even later Darwinists rejected in Charles Darwin himself. But so it's from this ethos that the ideologies or the propagandists of the Milner, Rothschild, Lionel Curtis, you know, this secret society, as it's described by Cecil Rhodes, the ideologues of this group will produce figures like H.G. Wells. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is that H.G. Wells was a product of this elite education. And all of these people come from Eton, Oxford, Cambridge, et cetera, et cetera. The British imperial elite, basically. And so what H.G. Wells is that is a he was not from a noble family. He was actually from a middle to lower class family, if I recall. But he was, I guess he showed promise, and so he was brought into this elite education. I don't remember which school he went to, but he had a knack for propaganda and for writing and so forth. So he was given all of the full education that the social, you know, elite of the UK get. And as a result, he becomes one of, I would say, probably the foremost propagandists. You know, it's not so much even Bernays as it is, you could argue, probably H.G. Wells is the most profound propagandist, perhaps, of the 20th century, because, you know, you might say, oh, well, what about Goebbels or, so, you know, Joseph Goebbels or something like that? Well, we are still feeling the effects of H.G. Wells with the smart city, with genetic modification, with Agenda 21, with all of the things that are coming in our future. I don't really think we're dealing with the effects of, you know, the Nazi program, unless you believe that the Nazis are attacking us from the moon or something. But
yeah, Iron Sky. Yeah,
Iron Sky. There's dinosaurs up there, too.
Yeah.
So Wells is the originator. Now, I'll have to give Alan Watt credit for this because I didn't know this until he mentioned it. But H.G. Wells came up with the poster of how to propagandize against the Germans for World War One, and he invented the idea of the Hun, right? This barbaric character. Mm-hmm. So he was very adept at propaganda posters and so forth, and invented all kinds of ideas that would become the staples, particularly of science fiction. You know, he speaks first of the atom bomb. He speaks of time travel. I mean, there probably had been some character writing about time travel before that. I don't know. But in our modern science fiction vernacular, it's certainly H.G. Wells with the time machine. The alien mythos, obviously, you know, War of the Worlds. And we all know about, you know, again, all the fiction tales. I'll spare us with that, because what we want to look at is some of his nonfiction works, which two of which come to the fore, which we will be covering both in my talks. And those two books are The Open Conspiracy and The New World Order, very easily titled for you so that you can figure out what they're about. The Open Conspiracy is the first book that I covered. And in it, what we have is not an idiot. You might think that he's a little goofy or a little weird, but no, you're actually dealing with somebody who's pretty sophisticated. And in fact, because I'd only read prior to this his fiction works, I was expecting his nonfiction to be a little dull, a little unsophisticated, but it wasn't. It was actually very clever when it comes to the tactics and techniques of how to infiltrate and subvert the existing structures. And H.G. Wells fervently believes in the Marxism and the socialism that he promotes, as far as I can tell. He was a high-level Freemason, and most high-level Freemasons certainly seem to have that same penchant for revolutionary socialism, communism, Marxism. But what he begins the book by discussing is the notion of selling an idea. And that the revolution that he's promoting, and he calls it a world revolution, is not so much a party it's not so much the limitations of Marxism. In fact, he's very critical of Orthodox classical Marxism. What he's selling is an idea that anyone can join. And anyone can join this idea by simply adopting the basic principles and the basic patterns of subversion. And he lays them all out for you. Very, very simple, very easy.
Yeah,
it's almost, that was, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, the way that you can easily convert to Islam. Just accept these four things, right? The, mm-hmm, the pillar, accept these basic pillars.
And you see these, I guess, these ideas and this form of activism, of course, being played out even today. That's what I found most interesting. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, you kind of see maybe a pre-Saul Alinsky.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In that's the way to character put it. Of Russell, or of Wells, excuse me, because Wells says that this idea is viewing everything in a new way. So in ways maybe similar to the idea of changing images of man, altering man's view of man, altering man's view of everything is what Wells was talking about. And he says that this will happen through not the erasing of existing structures, but through the infiltration of all existing structures and the changing of those exist. So in other words, H.G. Wells is a change agent. And what you will begin to notice in many of the globalist books series writers is this idea of the change agent. The change agent, again, is not necessarily the social justice warrior on the street with the pink hair and the man boobs. It's the professor. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's the guy at the university who just happens to show up at your college from the Eastern Bloc countries with the aid of the OSS. These are the change agents, and change agents are, of course, well funded, as was H.G. Wells, by this elite establishment class. But what we, where the book really gets fascinating is not just this kind of obvious communist type infiltration stuff, but the methods and the tactics and the actual statements of objectives. And what we have there is the abolition of private property, the abolition of family, abolition of the nuclear family, traditional family, abolition of gender roles, those typical type things that you might expect in, again, social justice warriors. You know, H.G. Wells was saying this 100 years ago. He describes the implementation of a completely new economy, a global economy, not based around individual commerce, sound finance, sound money, anything like that, but rather total technocracy. We have the suggestion of the total reorganization of society into planned communities, not just a planned community in the sense of like a retirement community where you pay your homeowners association, but mm-hmm. although actually I believe those things are preparations mm-hmm. for that because of the very bizarre examples of zoning laws and things like this that we're seeing in a lot of these planned communities, you know, very strange rules in some of these, you know, sort of upper suburban areas. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
Right. And I think these are in a way probably preparations for, because this fits into what you talked about with E. Michael Jones, with the creation of suburbia. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't just end with the dissolution of ethnic neighborhoods. There's a final goal, which is H.G. Wells level stuff. So yeah, basically we're looking at,
you need the atomization first.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. You got to break down before you build back up. Mm-hmm. And you will find that actually in many of these globalist writers too, is this principle of the dissolution and breaking down and then the reassembling of the thing, which is why, as we will mention here in a moment, Kessler will actually use alchemical terminology. Yeah. But so for Wells, a couple more points that we should hit on is the very fascinating statement that the pacifists and the liberal economic ideologues are not enemies, according to H.G. Wells. So in other words, H.G. Wells would find a common favor amongst libertarians. And in fact, this is something that he critiques the Marxists of in the book, is that he says, you're too short-sighted Marxists. You saw all of life as economic theory and modes of production. He said, that's not life. Life is much more than that. Life is, you know, aesthetics. Life is family. Life is all these things. Life is the environment, blah, blah, blah. He says, you got to realize that the revolution is total. The final revolution that Huxley talked about. Mm-hmm. And so what that requires is mass re-education. So the schools are one of the first places that are going to have to be infiltrated, and the modes of pedagogy and education will have to be altered and changed. This, by the way, is why I think you're correct in the opening statements that you made, that more individual and homeschool type movements are really going to be the best means going forward to counteract this system. Mm-hmm. And I think that the traditional universities and school systems are, they're already kind of dying away. Mm-hmm. And I think that individuals can basically, if they have enough energy and go get it attitude, they can educate themselves. And so really, you don't need that archaic system anymore. I'm not trying to be totally apocalyptic. I'm saying that you can work outside that system. That's essentially what I tried to do. Mm-hmm. With what I do is to set up means and modes for not having to rely on the traditional university system and being stuck in some professorship where, you know, I have to affirm Darwinism or abortion or euthanasia or whatever to get a job promotion. Mm-hmm. And I think that that will, a lot more people are going to opt for that kind of a thing as the technocratic era comes to the fore. Anyway, what I'm getting at is that you can 100% see this in Wells as he predicts and says all this is coming into play. He says that the nation state has to be destroyed, and one way that they can do that is through the promotion of pacifism in all liberal groups. So he's not just concerned with promoting Marxism. He's concerned with promoting any liberal groups, including libertarian and free trade proponents, because they have the effect of destroying existing cultures. And for H.G. Wells, that's double plus good.
Mm-hmm. You can't, because through commerce and trade, you break down local cultures and traditions. And you see this with the Starbucks, McDonald's, and Target, right?
I was going to say, yeah, I mean, anytime you go to a nice city, if you drive down to Florida and you find, you know, some kind of cool enclave that's like St. Augustine or St. Augustine, which is the oldest city in America, right? And you go downtown and it has this total Spanish vibe. Mm-hmm. You know, 500-year-old city or whatever. The architecture is Moroccan and Spanish. Mm-hmm. And then you drive, you know, a mile or two out of town, and then it's the CVS, Walgreens, McDonald's.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's a very big contrast because a mile or two out of town, and it looks like every other place in America. Then you go downtown and you find that, you know, there's a cathedral and there's, you know, ancient architecture and all this kind of stuff that's very fascinating, and all these old cemeteries that are 500 years old. And all. And what I'm getting at is that that is an example in everybody's city of the incursion of corporatism. And you might think what a lot of people fall into the dialectic of is thinking, H.G. Wells is a Marxist socialist, therefore he would not like the Shell and the BP and the
yeah,
the Walgreens and the CVS on the corner because they're capitalists. No. H.G. Wells is very clear that those, he says, in fact, he says, there's a great line. I wish I had the book here in front of me. I'd quote it. He says, you idiot Marxists. He says, who do you think will bring about internationalism if not the international corporations and bankers? Mm-hmm. He says, who else has the means and the power and the money to do it?
Yep.
He says, you can't have a world government without money behind it. He says, who else do you think is going to do it? Mm-hmm. It's not going to be, you know, some guy in a beret with a joint hanging out of his mouth, you know, with a some hippie guy somewhere. That's not going to bring the global revolution. It's going to take the power of global capitalism to do that.
I mean, examples of this sort of corporatization. I was listening to Catherine Austin Fitz talk, and she was talking about, well, you can look at Las Vegas, right? It's gone corporate.
Right.
When it used to be all mob. And so more or less the big guys came in, the mob served their purpose, and they were cast aside. And she was talking about the crackdown of what's called organized crime, the mafia, in the late 70s and 80s, wasn't so much a crackdown on criminal activity as it was a destruction of the mafia, because they had served their purpose in the dialectic in the process.
And there were deals with the CIA between the mafia.
Yes, and then they serve certain missions, right? Whether it's assassinations, some speculated, that was right. The Kennedy thing, but this human trafficking, drugs, these things, black budgets, off budget funding, and these things, and
blackmail,
I think even building, things like Disney World, things like that. Because you see that connection, with the same people working with the mafia, Mario Lansky, mm-hmm. working with the Disney Corporation to build Disney World. And a lot of problem, I have to imagine, is a lot of money, a lot of that liquid cash has got to be, same way it's money is laundered in Hollywood. But she was saying in the late 70s, early 80s, this crackdown of the mob, the traditional mob was severely weakened, if not destroyed, because the criminal operations they were involved in went corporate. And we see that with Las Vegas and Atlantic City. And she seemed to think that a lot of what's going on in Hollywood now might be an element here where, because of the changes in the entertainment industry, the studio system may be on its way out with other means of producing, like Netflix and
so it'll be Netflix and Disney basically running entertainment.
Yeah, and the middleman isn't needed anymore. And this is sort of a pushing out, and that could, right. That could be why all of a sudden these things matter now in Hollywood. The casting couch is a concern now, and you see this played out in certain movies too. I was watching Fargo, the series, and the second series involves the Kansas City mob going against a local family in North Dakota.
Yes, I have seen the second season. Right.
Oh, the German family, and they want the guy Milligan, that hitman, Mike Milligan. He's right. Talking about how the sheriff comes to talk. Can't you just stop? Empire always begins with everyone wanting more that's not theirs, and there's a lot of bloodshed. Can't you just not want what's yours? And he says, it's not just any one man, it's the future, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
He's almost like talking about the New World Order. It's corporate. And the beginning seasons where they're talking about coming in and buying out the family, this mob, the Chicago guys are meeting with local public officials and bribing them to get on their turn. And it's gone. And he says it's going corporate. And this is 1979, it's supposed to be. So I thought that's very interesting. It's kind of
it is, and then it ends with the real deep state who has the alien technology. If you remember the end of it.
Oh, I haven't seen the end of it yet.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay, but I know that, which is very. I'm working forward to it. That's very funny. Another, I've kind of mentioned it before.
Well, and by the way, I'm not saying it's about aliens. I think it's about the deep state has this real super technology.
Yeah, Area 51 crap. That's
what, yes.
Yeah. I might mention this before, that there is an episode of The Sopranos where these two mobs go in to shake down a local business. We're from the New Bergen Neighborhood Improvement Association, like you donate to our to our group. The police, I know this is an up and coming area. The police still have their hands full, and we can help protect your property. And the guy, it's like a Starbucks type business. And the guy says, listen, I don't have any discretion in funds. They count every dime that comes in here. I can't do anything. And they said, well, how about if the manager got his legs broken? And he goes, I don't think they'd care.
Really? Yeah, I remember that quote. Yeah.
And he goes, how about if your store window got broken? He says, I don't know. They own 20,000 stores. I don't think they really care. And they leave all dispirited, saying, there's nothing left for the little guy anymore.
Right.
So that's kind of but it's what we're talking. Sort of this, when you're talking about what's everything's losing its local flair or local flavor or what makes it distinct, and that's this globalization process.
And what's interesting about Wells is that I think a lot of right wingers might be misled if they were to hear that Wells was a communist or a Marxist, that he would dislike international corporatism.
Yeah.
And he doesn't dislike it. He likes it. He says that there's no other possible means by which internationalism would come to power. And he says that all you idiot Marxists who are orthodox Marxists, he says, you just haven't been paying attention. He says, how else will this happen? And what's interesting is that even Marx talked about that, was that there's really no other means by which the modes of production would become so advanced and so mechanized, other than through capitalism, to produce standardization and mechanization that would lead to the internationalism that would lead to the stateless, you know, Marxist world. Mm-hmm. Now, Wells, of course, doesn't care for the idea of being stateless. He's not really concerned with that, but he does share the utopian idea. And if anybody's interested in the full analysis, you know, they can hear the full talk, but basically ends the book, as we talked about before, by, you know, trying to sell it on Star Trek, sell the idea of the real possibility of creating utopia. There's even a very fascinating chapter on religion, which is a little more sophisticated than I expected from him. I obviously don't agree with him, but he at least had some good sophisticated questions that he was asking. And, you know, it's an example, I would say, maybe of an early notion or approach to full spectrum dominance.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be earlier versions of full spectrum dominance, unless maybe you could count Machiavelli or something like that. But I think Open Conspiracy really touches on environment. It touches on man himself, anthropology, his atmosphere, his genetics, his religion, his education, his commerce and economic theory. You know, it really tries to touch on everything and propose a philosophy of the future. And as many writers and critics have this kind of an ideology have said, is that one of the reasons that these ideologies are successful is that, unlike failed ideologies, they offer a kind of eschatology, a kind of future hope, which a lot of ideologies fail to see the importance of future hope. And Marxism is a kind of bastardized Christianity in many ways.
Yeah.
But it does retain the Christian notion of some future hope or eschatology. And of course, obviously it's not supernatural. So it's just been transposed into the material plane, where the idea of basically the smart city, you know, this is what Wells is talking about.
And the smart city, that's the Enterprise or something, the smart city.
Yeah. And of course, Wells, I'm sure, believes in, you know, that role. Well, he wrote that book a long time ago, The Men on the Moon, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he seems to have pioneered all of America's great so-called scientific discoveries, didn't he?
Yes, yes. That's funny. He had great
atomic bomb, going to the moon, GMOs.
He had wonderful foresight, didn't he? Yeah. He says that the quote is, "The establishment of the world community will surely exact a price, and who can tell what the price may be?" Well, obviously, it's mountains of skulls, right?
Oh, that's another great point, too. Yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah, he does say, yes, many will die. Sorry, it's very unfortunate, but, you know, it's what we... And to bring Star Trek to fruition, it will, you know, as Dostoevsky said, take mountains of skulls.
Mm-hmm. And another interesting quote that you mentioned was that he says the new world order will be in place, will be imposed, and most people won't even notice it, right?
He's all for the Fabian gradualism
model,
right?
And he said he talked about like getting women out of the home and into the labor market working, and this would take their eyes off childish concerns like children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you see that all around you because. Well, I mean, obviously, women in their early 20s, mid-20s, many of them aren't thinking about children. That's when they should be thinking about
it. Yes, this is a great point. I'm glad you mentioned it. I forgot to mention it. That's actually how he begins the book, is discussing that change happens and most people don't even notice it.
Mm-hmm.
And he says because the Fabians figured that out, they figure that the most sneaky model, subtle model of passing all this on the entire world would be through that slow kill model. And he says, you know, people don't even realize that, I think he says something like, you know, 50 years ago, you couldn't ride a train anywhere in Europe and now you can. And he says, therefore I project that in the future, you know, it'll be even easier to go anywhere in the world. And he says, the ease of travel thus makes globalism inevitable, basically, is what he says.
Yeah, and you never want to settle down anywhere. It makes you, you'll never be content.
Rootless.
Rootless. Yeah, rootless. And one thing that you notice in today's culture, if you talk about no one in their early 20s is, you know, a girl is talking about getting married. That's not even a respectable.
No, it's do you want to be a lawyer? Do you want to be on? Do you want to be the person on CSI analyzing the semen to see who killed the, you know, who killed the prostitute? And you're going to be like the people on CSI.
Yeah. And so you got to work. You got to be some wage slave for some corporation. That's arriving in the New World Order. That's what you're supposed to be, you know. And that's why people don't notice the New World Order, because they've been changed. They've been psychologically altered just through the perversion of culture. And that's why his emphasis on full spectrum dominance, cultural, political, economic, is so important. And that's why he's calling for a world economic order through centralized banking, because through control of credit and resources, you can more or less, you can guide most people to their final destination, which is, you know, which is a gulag or a concentration camp or something. You know?
Yes, and if people were allowed, you know, commerce outside of that system, if you didn't regulate and control all commerce, you would have people setting up their own thing.
Yeah.
That can't be. In other words, you can't have a guy who's, you know, has a successful business and provides for his family, because the purpose of him doing that is having a family, and that's the number one thing that has to be stopped in the New World Order is a family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in other words, commerce goes directly towards that kind of stuff.
And that's why you cited that article got my Global Research recording the totalitarian Europe and the important function of the Bank of International Settlements. In creating an anti-life, very insightful article. If it could,
it was a very good article. Yes, the Rose woman, I forget her first name.
Yeah,
Julian Rose.
Yeah, just very anti-life, and it's neither left nor right. It's both, actually, and that's what the befuddled, contented, anxious middle class don't understand as they watch Fox News or MSNBC and worry about who's getting elected. Yeah, so.
Right, and you know, this plan has marched on unabated, despite whoever's elected.
Mm-hmm.
That's the big kicker. But yeah, I think that pretty much sums up, you know, the Wells section.
But Arthur Kessler's interesting because, of course, he's an interesting character. I knew him first through his book Darkness of Noon, a sort of a disenchanted Marxist who saw the horrors of Stalinism. Of course, he's writing that. He becomes a hero after World War II because you have the Cold War, so he's sort of feted by the Anglo-American establishment, Arthur Kessler. But he has this book, Ghost in the Machine, which acknowledges sort of a metaphysical reality to all this, right?
Correct, yeah. The first third of the book is arguments against rank materialism and reductionism, most of which are good arguments, many of which I made, not knowing that, you know, as Kessler had made these same arguments, but... There have been for a long time people critiquing psychologism and reductionism and materialism for its own inherent contradictions. And so when you're reading this, you're thinking, wow, this is actually pretty good. He's really saying some awesome stuff. And then you get, about halfway through the book and you're starting to realize where he's taking you, which is not to, to dare question anything like Darwinism itself, but rather to something more, maybe we might say New Age. We might be moving in a more New Age direction without shedding any of the scientistic presuppositions. So we want to keep the veneer of scientism, and I almost want to say that given his penchant for spiritism, mesmerism, and he actually funded the chair. His estate funded the first chair of parapsychology somewhere. I forget where, but... yeah, basically we kind of get this maybe theosophic type ideas or maybe Rudolf Steiner type ideas, because Kessler is not at all saying that evolution is false or that we need to reconsider Darwinism, or he's not even really promoting theistic evolution. It's, again, something much more akin to something in New Age. I couldn't really even find Dawkins kind of speaks in the vein of that he could accept pantheism.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the best way to describe Kessler, is just some kind of pantheism, which is basically meaningless. Might as well just being atheist doesn't matter. Because by the middle of the book, we start to get these statements about, well, even though we can't accept materialism, we notice that biological systems have a holistic character and they seem to function as a whole in the smaller systems within an overall system need one another to function properly. And that actually shows that you can't have pure materialism, because pure materialism wouldn't produce all of these independent systems. You know, the eye is its own kind of system that needs tissue, that needs blood, needs nerves, you know, the heart, the glands, you know, all these different bodily systems. And each, even the cell itself, is its own little computer factory. And then he, you know, goes into DNA and all this stuff. So, one would think that he might question Darwinism at some point, but no, anyone working for the behavioral sciences unit of the Royal Society is not going to ever question Darwinism. I can assure you that.
Yeah.
But that's why, by the way, that's what this book was produced for, was for the behavioral sciences study of the Royal Society. Anyway, so since we have holistic systems and since we don't have materialism, but we do have Darwinism, what's becoming noticeable in post-1950s writers who promote globalism, important globalist writers post-1950, is that they're much more amenable to the ideas of, quote, spirit. It seems that they had all kind of at some point agreed upon the difficulty of selling everyone on rank materialism and Darwinism, and so rather Darwinism can fit much more easily into something pseudo-spiritual, where man is evolving into godhood, and thus the promotion post-50s and 60s of the New Age. You know, this fits very well with what Kessler talks about. So we could see Kessler maybe as a kind of a predecessor to Esalen Institute or New Age movement. And what he proposes is that, look, Darwinism is true because of mutations, right? There's all these mutations. cells mutate. We have aberrations in nature. And therefore, since man himself is an aberration in nature, because the arising of man, I couldn't believe he said this, but he says the rise of man from Neolithic man is out of cannibalism. And he says a pecking man is a cannibal. And so, because pecking man was a cannibal, we can surmise that there's nothing inherently wrong about being parasitic on your own species. And he says, look, we observe this in nature. We all believe in nature in some sense. So therefore, anything that happens in nature is normal and, quote, natural. And since cannibalism happens in nature, since pecking man is the beginning of conscious man out of caveman state, there's nothing wrong with being parasitic. And then he goes on to actually cite the examples of Aztecs and human sacrifice, cannibalism. I'm not joking. That's what he talks about. He doesn't speak of it in a negative light. He says, look, this has gone on. And he says, basically, is this not nature at work? Is a black plague not nature at work? And if the black plague and if cannibalism are just merely manifestations of nature, there's absolutely nothing wrong with creating bioweapons to mutate man. There's nothing wrong with flipping the gender of people through chemicals in the food, water, and atmosphere. This is what he says, by the way. So that's what we get with this character, who I definitely think I think you could definitely say he's an Illuminist. He speaks of Thanatos, Greek for death, as the operant principle in nature that is just as powerful and important as life. So I think Zoe is the Greek word for life. So Zoe and Thanatos are equal principles in nature. And so here we get this Masonic sort of dualism where good is evil and evil is good. Why? Because good and evil are just based on principles of nature, and nature is both death and life. So since everything is natural, and since the elite are basically the highest, and he shares this with Salk and Russell, by the way, since they are the highest forms of evolution, there is nothing wrong with them as the minstrels of evolution. enacting basically a kind of mass kill-off, depopulation. He says, because the elite function as the immune system of the planet. This is what Salk says, too.
That's, yeah. That's, so, yeah, it's almost, so they've ordained themselves.
Yes. And Salk, by the way, this is funny because Salk actually tries to explain this. And he says, look, if you were the true priests of nature, you would understand what I'm talking about. And since you don't believe in it or understand it, you're not the incarnation of Mother Nature.
Yeah, and of course, nature's nothing sacred or special about nature. It's just they're mutating all the time, and
it's just mutating process of life and death, right?
So you can't base anything on nature to as a foundation for behavior or what's normal or what's proper, and it's there to be experimented upon. He cites Peking Man, but of course, wasn't Peking Man discovered to be a fraud?
Yep.
Oh well.
Right. Ghost in the Machine is, of course, 1967, I think. So this is prior to the outing of Nebraska Man, Peking Man, and Piltdown Man as frauds.
Thus, again, showing the function of Darwinism in creating this worldview that justifies genocide, more or less.
Correct. It is the epitome of the Victorian ethos, Anglo-Saxon preeminence. But that's not really Anglo-Saxon preeminence. It's more of a kind of degenerate elite intermarried into various groups, including people always say, well, what does this have to do with the Talmud? Well, the Talmud speaks of most humans as beasts. Mm-hmm. So you could see that this elite Darwinian ancient Hindu philosophy. And by the way, the British, of course, had that same penchant for the Hindu caste system, right? That can easily blend with the Talmudic idea of most so-called humans not having a nefesh or a soul.
Yeah, and this, of course, you've pointed out that, you know, with back to H.G. Wells, he's writing The Open Conspiracy roughly the same time that Aldous Huxley is penning Brave New World. And it's a very similar view. And it
is funny. Yes, I forgot to mention Brave New World should also be included in the Globalist book series, right? Mm-hmm.
But of course, Jonas Salk, in his book, The Survival of the Wisest, of course, he's telegraphing or referring to, you know, survival of the fittest and Darwin, that idea. Why Jonas Salk, however disturbing his views are, of course, most people know Jonas Salk as the father, the heroic figure who produced the first polio. Here we go. Okay, we're back. Jonas Salk, father of the polio vaccine, here's this person who's pioneering vaccinations. Of course, he's an advocate of depopulation, right?
Yes. One more thing I did want to mention on Kessler that's fascinating was just that he does have that towards the end of the book, those last few chapters that deal with mutating man.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And the mutating man chapter is a section that I included in my book, Esoteric Hollywood, where you do have a discussion of a 1966 or 7 CIA conference in San Francisco called the Control of the Mind Conference. And this was part of MKUltra. Mm-hmm. You also have Kessler in a pretty significant section discussing MKUltra. And he's talking about the possibilities of implantable electrodes in the mind and what they could do with shocking different hemispheres of the brain. And what I'm getting at is that Kessler was privy to this back in the 60s, whereas most people weren't, precisely because he either attended or knew about this mind control conference in San Francisco that was funded by Radio Liberty and the CIA. Excuse me. And at this conference, they literally do discuss altering the RNA, DNA, to cause various types of not just experiments, but also mutations, sterility, cancer, et cetera, et cetera. So you have explicit statements from these guys about what their plans are.
And of course,
I just want to make that clear. Yeah.
And it's also important, these books and what's in them, with the ideas that are contained in these books, these aren't the musings of some crackpots. These are people who are well-connected, they're high up. And
this is an Order of the British Empire,
yeah,
honored man, great writer of the 20th century. Mm-hmm.
And you can, and if you study the past 50, 60, maybe 75 years, you'll see elements of this program being implemented in various policies. They had,
right,
the World Health Organization, you know.
Oh, yeah, great example.
Sterilized women with HGC hormone in the tetanus shots to, mm-hmm, sterilize them. I think a third of the Rockefeller Foundation sterilized a third of childbearing women in Puerto Rico in the 1940s and 50s.
Oh, wow. Okay, you know? Yeah.
There's talk of contraceptive corn, which William Engdahl writes about in his book Seeds of Destruction. Mm-hmm. Of course, the big issue, GMOs and seeds and these things. GMO food being robbed of nutrients.
Oh, absolutely.
These things makes everyone sick and weaker, right? The reversal of the food pyramid back in the 70s.
Yes, under Carter, right? Yeah. Ford and Carter, right?
Yeah, so this is all part of that. Bertrand Russell talked about through diet and
injections.
Injunctions, right? Yeah. So these people, this program has been implemented at varying time or varying degrees over the years that you can point to, and it's just a question of connecting the dots and stop seeing these things as episodes or separate events. There's a continuum here. There's a connection.
Yeah, discontiguous.
Yeah.
Sorry,
we didn't mean to did it oops. Again.
We accidentally sprayed a city in St. Louis with bioweapon. Oops, sorry.
And of course, with Jonas Salk, the whole narrative of the polio, poliomyelitis being virus-based and these things is somewhat dubious. If you look at it, it was probably, at least it appears to be, paralysis that people suffered, perhaps was something else, multi-factor pollutant, poisons in the environment. There was the DDT spraying that was going on. There was a wide use of arsenic by dentists at that time. There's all types of things that might have caused paralysis. Mm-hmm. But they blamed, this poliomyelitis, this virus, and they developed this vaccine, which actually crippled people, which why they originally Salk vaccine was pulled off the market and the Sabin vaccine was put on the market. And what they did during that period in the 50s when they introduced the Salk, I think it was 1954, if I have that right, mm-hmm, at the very time they were introducing the vaccination, they're narrowing the diagnostic parameters of poliomyelitis. So what they're saying was they didn't get rid of polio, they just redefined, mm-hmm, it. There are still, mm-hmm, kids suffering from paralysis.
No. Oh, wow. Interesting. If I recall, there's a lot of similar material that's mentioned in Haslam's Dr. Mary's Monkey book, which, yes, is pretty good.
Yeah, that's the SV40 controversy.
That's the SV40 simian virus, yeah, which that famous CBC clip with Dr. Maurice Hilleman, mm-hmm, where he's saying, oh, yeah, they're laughing about it. Oh, yeah, we put this in the vaccine. And it gave a bunch of people cancer, but mm-hmm, it's a funny thing.
Which made a lot of people money 20 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to believe. I mean, a lot of people don't understand or don't appreciate or they don't understand how, something as sinister could be thought of and implemented.
Remember Bill Gates in his COP 2 lecture at TED Talk, where he says, if we get the right vaccines, we can get this population number down over the next couple of decades.
Yeah, he calls it reproductive health.
Mm-hmm.
You know that you were talking about the thanatosis, this obsession with death.
Mm-hmm.
You see that. Obviously in what we call reproductive medicine, because reproductive medicine today, yes, has very little to do with actually fertility. It's quashing fertility and controlling fertility.
This is actually discussed by Salk. So you're absolutely right. Salk in his Survival of the Wisest rephrases Darwin from the fittest to the wisest. And of course he means the scientific priest class, mm-hmm, the Darwinian priest class. the servants, you know, of the Rockefellers who were funding all the vaccine inoculation, mass inoculation stuff. So what Salk proposes in this book is that there was Epic A, which was mankind all the way up until the time of Jonas Salk.
Oh, okay.
And Epic A was the time of population explosion. And he says, oh, look, we had these fruit fly tests where we put a bunch of fruit flies in a bubble, and they reproduced to such an extent that they all died. And look at the graphs here and the charts that I have of the population explosion of humans, and can't you see the parallel? It's very scientific. It's all these graphs and charts. Look how we're going to be like the fruit flies, right? So you have, again, the repetition of this old...
He's just not Thomas Malthus, yeah.
It's another Malthusian scare tactic. Crisis, catastrophism. And who does he cite for all this? Paul Ehrlich. Paul Ehrlich, yeah, the co-author of Ecoscience, I believe, and the father of the Ice Age. We're all going to die in the coming Ice Age of the 70s and 80s.
The Population Bomb, yeah, that book.
Right.
And this of course, this informs the Club of Rome and Maurice Strong eventually and implements Agenda 21. So this, and it's interesting because I think Paul Ehrlich is an entomologist.
Mm-hmm. He knows bugs.
He knows bugs. And you know, I think
humans are viewed as bugs.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the same way that you know, Alfred Kinsey was a zoologist, you know.
All right.
Act like an animal. Everyone's an animal.
Yeah.
If you look at, of course, if you just look at the whole history of vaccinations and public health and these things, of course, the health revolution occurred before any mass vaccination program. Actually, it can be attributed to just better hygiene, public sanitation, and better diet. Nothing to do with medical intervention. And the problems of health, of course, we've had this tightening or increase of the scheduling for vaccinations, an increase increase in chronic health problems, allergies, explosion allergies, and of course, not to mention autism, which you and Chris have speculated could be a plan. And when you listen to the videotape of Maurice Hillman laughing, knowingly tainting these things with SV40 virus, I think that would cause cancer. It's a polyoma would cause soft tissue cancer. You have to talk soft. Now we're in the middle of a soft tissue cancer epidemic in young people, which will also increase, you know, that will have an effect on fertility and life and these things. And strangely enough, it also, some of these cancers attack parts of the body that had to do with fertility in nurturing, whether breast cancer, ovarian cancer.
Oh, this is exactly what Salk says. He says that we, as the priestly class, must take on the difficult responsibility of weaponizing and engineering not just the principles of life in nature, but also death. And he says that this can be done in various ways. He says that we can cause disadvantageous or advantageous effects through manipulating the eggs, the reproductive system of the woman, or in other ways, the males as well. So, he explicitly says this more than once in the book. And, you know, I had a Daily Beast writer who tries to defend all this stuff. He was arguing with me a couple of days ago, and I said, he said basically that everything I was saying was bullshit. And I said, well, did Jonas Salk write this book? And it took him a few minutes, and he finally replied and said, he said, you don't believe in modern medicine. So, total straw man. Never said I don't believe in modern medicine. In fact, I don't even have a problem with getting an inoculation. I had pneumonia a year and a half, 2 years ago, and I'm very glad that I got that shot of antibiotic in my butt, and it got rid of the pneumonia. So I'm not disagreeing with antibiotics and modern medicine. What I'm saying is the notion that the local schools and local hospitals are following a big pharma mandate that says that you have to get 60 vaccines by the time you're however many, 36 months old or whatever.
Yeah.
That is insane.
Mm-hmm.
And that is obviously something to do, because all those same big pharma companies are the ones mentioned by Maurice Hillerman, and that he was, in that case, they were working with Merck, and if you look at Salk and Salk Institute, you know, this is all connected to Merck as well. Hillerman mentioned Salk. So Salk is basically an agent of the corporate Rockefeller apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
He's like one of the front men. He's a kind of Carl Sagan, Neil deGrasse Tyson of Big Pharma is all he is. And that's why he's propped up as a hero on the cover of Time magazine.
Yeah, Time magazine, of course, Henry Luce.
Yep.
They also promoted Kinsey, and they're, you know.
Yes, good point.
Yeah. And you put him in a white coat. This is the age of science, and there's.
And he holds up some tubes with some liquids of color in it.
Look, a beaker and a lot of numbers. Look at all those numbers. I'm intimidated. I can't question that. There are numbers on the board. I mean, I can't question that. So, you know, it's okay to give my infant newborn son a shot for hepatitis B vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these things with full of mercury or whatever happens to fall in there when it's being developed in China or something, some factory in China.
Oh, right.
And again, this, the idea that someone would write a book like this with these manipulating or the pirating or manipulating of the reproductive process, the intentional poisoning of the mm-hmm. population with the purpose of curbing population growth is changing humanity. And this guy's a hero. And you're going to trust him to put a needle in your arm?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different ways we could critique this guy. And, for example, most of the modern Darwinians, you know, the deGrasse, Tyson, Dawkins types, would affirm that they are scientists and not into metaphysics. However, when I read Jonas Salk's book, he's very comfortable consistently talking about metaphysics in his speculations about metabiology and the ego being of man, none of which is observed in a microscope, by the way,
yeah.
None of which is empirical, all of which is a metaphysical speculation connected to his religion. And he does actually describe it in many religious glowing terms. So I'm having a hard time figuring out how exactly his use of metaphysics, quote unquote, is allowable, but anyone else discussing metaphysics would be called a kook, a medieval superstition, retard, retrograde, you know, regressive. Next, we could consider the fact that he calls any position that claims to be dogmatic and certain egomaniacal and characteristic of epoch A of man, which is where man could be self-willed in order to propel the species towards greater population. He says, but now we've entered epoch B, and in order to avoid the annihilation of the species, we must kill off most of the species. So in other words, he says that if you are objective in your morals and your beliefs and your views, and if you're dogmatic, he says you are regressive and part of epoch A of mankind, which is done with. You are part of devolution. He says that we, the scientific priest class, are part of epoch B, which is where the scientists step forward to engineer evolution to control population on a mass level. And thus, the survival of the wisest is the only way for the species to go into the future. So in other words, by his own qualifications, being the most dogmatic imaginable, he himself has refuted himself. Because he says that if you're dogmatic, you're part of the old age. But he has the most dogmatic view imaginable, because he actually says that there need to be structures in place to get rid of people that believe in absolutist morals or God or any of that stuff. Basically, Christians or conservatives need to be killed, is what he's saying.
Yeah. Which is why this group has always promoted sort of this ecumenical mysticism, you know, which has spirituality, but no real doctrine or faith or morality to it. Yeah.
But wait a minute, though. Now, on one level, that's right. But what I'm saying is that this is actually a trick. And behind those idiots who believe that nonsense, you actually have the most fanatical zealot religion ever that is intent on being way more extreme than the Inquisition.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the Inquisition didn't say that everybody had to die. And here you have these religious zealots saying, in order for the species to survive, we must enact genocide.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I think you made the point how under traditional society or religions, that there are certain strictures or rules about how you conduct yourself, how you live, and these things, how you behave. But they don't have speech codes or thought codes. There's no thought crimes. But under mm-hmm. under these people, there's speech codes, there's thought crime, all these things. So they're far more restrictive than any traditional religion in the final analysis. Yeah,
that's a great point. Yeah. And I remember years ago, Alex Jones would talk about how the Agenda 21 people cite the Aztecs and the Incas and the Mayas as potential kinds of religions to emulate in the future, mm-hmm. that the green movement could learn from those kinds of cannibalistic cults. And I thought that sounded a bit extreme. I was like, where's he getting that? And he would always mention some UN document. I never could find it. And now that I've actually read some of these guys, that's actually not far fetched. I mean, that would, Kessler says that he's a fan of the Aztecs and the Mayans. And Salk could easily fit into that, because Salk says, like Kessler, that death is natural, and if death is natural, then there's not really any metaphysical distinction between birthing and killing. They're just actions. There's not one better or less than the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ultimately speaking, you might not like it, but there's not one better or less than the other.
Yeah.
It's just a vast cosmic, you know, process. That's all there is to it. So what I'm getting at is that I didn't really go into this in depth, but I'm sure some people will take issue with this. But this is a very strong argument against theistic evolution, by the way, because anyone who espouses theistic evolution essentially has to believe that death is in some sense natural, and that death occurred for millions of aeons, you know, prior to the rise of Adam and Eve, or, you know, caveman, or whatever you believe in. And if death is natural, I would challenge anyone to explain how Kessler and Salk are wrong. How is death not just as good or necessary as life? Mm-hmm. And I think I don't want to necessarily try to get into an argument or go too far afield, but this is one of the strongest points, I think, for traditional Orthodox Christianity, is that, you know, we believe Christ is the antidote to death. And so he destroys all of death. You know, Paul says this in Romans 8, that the entire creation groans to be delivered from the bondage of the corruption that Adam brought.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the whole point, really, of the resurrection.
Yeah, there's a profound philosophical I guess you could say a concession being made there.
We believe that the resurrection is cosmic in scope. In other words, that it will essentially remedy mm-hmm. not just the death of man's soul, but of course the resurrection of man and the renovation of the cosmos. And that's relevant because it actually counteracts the full extent of what Adam brought in the fall. And if you don't believe in Adam and Eve in the fall, you really can't explain death. And so, in other words, this is this is why, for example, Genesis we believe is part of Revelation. In other words, the doctrine of creation is not natural. If you were like a Thomist or something, but creation is actually a revealed doctrine. Mm-hmm. That's why none of these people come up with it. You don't ever see a natural philosopher come to believe in ex nihilo creation ever. Yeah. They never do. They always propose some process philosophy or some sort of pantheism or paganism. Anyway, I'm just making a point that what you do see in Kessler and Salk is them in a way trying to be consistent in a very dark way with the idea of the presence of death in nature, and we see the present world as very unnatural. Right, death mm-hmm. is unnatural for us. It is not at all natural.
I always thought the attempt to rationalize theistic view with Darwinism, theistic Darwinism, was an attempt made by Christians, particularly the Catholic Church, when the Pope wrote that wasn't necessarily a contradiction there. Was a belief that somehow the evidence for Darwinism was so overwhelming,
right,
that they had to make some sort of concession, which I've never found the evidence for Darwinism to be that compelling to begin with. So
right.
Why even make that concession? You know, it's like,
Yeah, and it's very curious too that it's a lot of these Jesuits that pioneer it. And I think that they were already kind of corrupt by the time they're pioneering and really promoting this stuff. And by the time you get Teilhard de Chardin, who, by the way, I should include in my globalist book series because he is an important illuminist. Teilhard de Chardin basically sees Darwinism as Christianity. I mean, he reinterprets the entirety of Christianity into a process philosophy of Darwinism where everything is evolving to a kind of omega point, which is basically just kind of Hegelianism in some way. It's a version of Hegelianism, process philosophy, and Darwinism under the guise of paleontology. And by the way, isn't it interesting that he pops up at several of these frauds? I don't remember the exact ones, but I think he's at Piltdown. And he pops up in one of the other ones, like Nebraska Man, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Why is he there?
Yeah.
And by the way, he was so bad, he was actually excommunicated by either Pius XII or even John the 23rd. I mean, he was like really out there. I mean, I think he was rehabilitated by John the 23rd, if I recall, or something to that degree, but to that effect. But anyway, I think that these, when you really look at the guys who are the exemplars of that worldview, the Kesslers and the Salks and the Russells, there's just absolutely no way you could meld those with Christianity. And another argument I'll make too, that you don't really hear people make much, is it's not just a question of the difficulties of interpreting the texts of Genesis 1 and 2. There's another problem, and that's the problem of the way that Jesus speaks of Adam, Eve, and Genesis 1 and 2, which you have to soon say, I guess those gospel texts were Christ just talking about Adam and Eve as actual people, and where he talks about the creation of Adam and Eve. Well, I guess those are wrong too. And then what you've done is basically open the door to higher criticism, because now in order to save your presuppositions about what you're saying in theistic evolution about Genesis 1 and 2, you've got to now reinterpret or revise or redact the Gospels.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wait a minute. Uh-oh. I guess we also have to look at Paul's epistles, because Paul talks about creation and he talks about Adam and Eve, right? Oh, we got to redact those too.
And that's the ball rolling.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't understand that you have to follow through there to be consistent. Yeah.
Because the higher criticism, I guess, has a broad cultural impact of making people accept something like Darwinism.
Absolutely.
Dialectical materialism, denying the universe of the a teleocratic meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, that would be the type of worldview that the men who run the British Empire would want to promote, because that's the Newtonian world and, these things. Yeah.
Right.
Is there any? I mean, you mentioned this. It's funny that it was the Process Church, the Final Judgment.
Good point.
I mean,
yeah.
Very similar to this. I mean, I'm looking at this. The good, evil. Even with, you had the passing of Charles Manson, who said, "I'm the devil. I'm God." Right.
Exactly.
So he was. Whatever you can make sense, whatever sense you can make out of his rantings, you saw that in that type of idea that good and evil have to exist, therefore evil is God's will too, right? Because it's part of this process. Mm-hmm. If I have that doctrine of theology, if you want to call it that, correct.
Yeah, interesting. I was reading a modern academic approach to ancient Vedic texts recently, and in the ancient Vedic texts there were a lot of similar philosophical debates going on thousands of years ago. And the essence of those debates was over monism and dualism. And what you'll see in the history of philosophy, not just in ancient Eastern, but in the history of Western philosophy up into the Greeks and so forth, especially with the Egyptians too, the Hermetica, is the same kind of debate into Plato, into Aristotle, up into, the medieval guys, and then into especially somebody like Hegel or Whitehead, whose whole philosophy is basically process philosophy. And then Darwin too, or Marx, is this dialectic of the one and the many. And the idea here is basically, is reality at its fundamental base one thing or two things or more? Is it one thing or many things? And so what you get is a tension. There's an assumption that there's a tension between monism, which is the idea that all reality is one thing, or a dualism that all reality is a fundamental positive, negative, day, night, black, white, right? And this is characteristic, of course, of like many ancient Far Eastern or like Chinese Shinto Taoist type views. So the reason this is relevant is that most world religions will actually fall into one of those two categories. And even, I'm not obviously a fan of ancient Hinduism, but I'm saying that they kind of noticed this, interestingly, that they were all debating, hey man, everything's either one thing or a bunch of things. So what you're getting at with the examples of the modern cults are really just manifestations of that same problem, where fundamental reality is conceived of as, if you conceive of it as one thing, then everything that manifests is essentially an illusion, because anything that's distinct is illusory. This is why they have that the doctrine of Maya in ancient Hindu philosophy. It's just an illusion because everything's just one thing, right? And atomism is in a way a kind of version of this, because they're saying, oh yeah, it looks like there's a table and there's a chair and there's me and there's you, but at base, we're just atoms. So the distinctions, they're all meaningless because we all just return to being meaningless bouncing atoms, and then we come back in some new form perhaps, yeah. Right? And then you have, well, maybe it's dualism. Maybe everything is a fundamental positive negative charge, or day and night, black and white. But there's not really any clear way to distinguish at times which is which. And so ironically, a lot of times dualism will often collapse into monism or solipsism. A great example of this would be Descartes. Descartes' philosophy, for example, posits a strong dialectical tension or contrast between the body and the soul. So one might think that Descartes' view is very dualistic, or this is Cartesian dualism, as it's often called. However, the more that you delve into Descartes, the more difficult it became for Descartes to figure out whether there was an external world of body at all. In other words, isn't it all just in his mind?
Yeah.
So in other words, Descartes' philosophy of dualism very easily slipped into solipsism. And solipsism is just another version of monism, because it says that all that exists is mind. Everything is just a manifestation of my mind. So we're back at Maya now. We're back at illusion, dream philosophy. We're in the matrix, man. So how do we ever get out of the matrix? Well, that's the trick. You don't. You never know when you're out. So what I'm getting at is these, all the world philosophies, basically, world religions, they all, almost always, devolve into and fall into this basic trap and problem. Now, the one that I believe is why I believe it is partly because I don't believe it falls into this trap, but that's a different topic. But what I'm getting at is that Process Church is a very clear example of another one of these manifestations of, oh, let's just take one of the ancient debates of ancient religion and philosophy, dualism, monism, and let's prepackage it into a new kind of cult. And if you consider, for example, Masonry, as many Masons do, just a symbolic interpretation of forces and principles of nature, then you will see again how this very easily bridges to Salk and Kessler, because what do you see in nature? Well, you see a generative principle. So there's your obelisks. You see the vaginal principle. So there's your, I don't know, Vesica Pisces or something like that. You see day and night, black and white, male, female. So there's your dualism. There's your Jake and Boaz. You see all of this in nature. And so since nature exemplifies all of these things, is there really any one that's preeminent over the other one? Not really. I mean, positive and negative numbers, right? So everything becomes kind of encapsulated under this Masonic reading of nature. And so therefore what I'm getting at is just that distinctions are again eliminated, and in that way, Jesus is just as much Satan as Satan is Jesus, which is blasphemous. But what I'm saying is that they are saying that it's just a manifestation of principles in nature. And what do you, again, what do you see in nature? Well, you're born, yeah, but you also die.
Yeah.
Birth, death, life, death. So it's all the same.
And it's a, I guess you could, one could rationalize very easily just being a deviant or degenerate with that type of worldview.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Crowley said that the essence of Crowleyism, I don't remember where, but there's some quote where he says that the essence of Crowleyism is that no act is any greater or lesser than any other act.
Yeah, and which is why this whole thing on inversion and transvaluation and thing is very
exactly prominent.
Yeah.
And that's how you will, oh, well, everything balances out.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, you have, that's why you have the black mass.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, something like sodomy is so prevalent in Crowleyan.
Mm-hmm.
Something, because it's a, you want to, I guess it's a, what's the word I'm looking for?
Well, a person of that view might say, Oh, you come presenting pro-life. Well, I believe in nature, and nature has just as much of a principle of death as it does pro-life.
Yeah, which goes back to that.
What do you see? What do you see in nature? You see predator and prey. You see disease. You know,
which goes back to your what you're talking about, the idea of the fall, and the notion of Genesis, the importance of accepting that story. Because
this is a yes. Yeah, yeah. This is exactly what Father Seraphim Rose argues in his gigantic Genesis book. Is it early on in the book, he says, look, this is why Genesis is so important. It's just as important as the Gospels, because you really can't understand the purpose of Christ coming without a historic fall. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we have to believe Ken Ham and every evangelical.
They're
not properly interpreting the text. You know, we look to the church fathers and the councils and so forth, the tradition of the church. But yes, you have to understand that. And another interesting point that he makes, too, is that in those early, we don't actually understand what it was like in Eden. So we, as Orthodox, we would say that there's a very disruptive state, or a very disruptive change occurred from the way that life was lived in Eden as to the way life is lived now.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we would not say that even death in the animal kingdom, right, mosquitoes or whatever, that would not be the normal mode of operation in the Edenic state. And this is why, for example, a lot of people don't know this, but this is why, for example, you don't have the mentioning of eating meat until Noah. A lot of people think that meat eating was going on, but actually it wasn't. It's not until Noah that you actually have the allowance of eating meat. So that's because the things were still very close to the Edenic period. But I'm just trying to stress that we don't believe that Eden was. It's not like, you know, some place over in Egypt somewhere or on a mountain somewhere, that it was actually a completely different metaphysical state of being, where matter and spirit were not kind of divided as they are in a post-fall state. And this is the way Paul speaks of it in Romans 8.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You recently had a very interesting video, Cults, Hollywood Espionage, and Large-Scale Social Engineering. And in that talk, you kind of covered what's going on in Hollywood now, and kind of explaining it, giving your own interpretation, what's really going on there. Do you want to quickly get into that, or do we have time? Or okay, we're back. So, Cults, Hollywood Espionage, and Large-Scale Social Engineering. Great piece, and yeah, you include that Randy Quaid thing.
Oh, yeah.
Which, well, anyway, I'll let you talk about it.
Well, I was trying to remember what all I said in that talk. I was exhausted. I spent like the whole day on that one. I think I was talking about, I think I started with the Dutroux affair.
Yeah. And,
you know, I found some documentary stuff on that was neat, where people who were directly involved in investigating it and whatnot said that, hey, it looks like, you know, he was getting some help from high up.
Yeah.
Which, you know, kind of confirms the so-called conspiracy theory. And that was because it involved, you know, high up people in government and so forth in Belgium. And that what I was just saying is that we see these patterns with, you know, networks that traffic people and so forth, and then how the similar patterns emerge in the scandals of Hollywood people. And we were talking about, I was talking about the Harvey Weinstein case, and that it actually came out in multiple mainstream news sources, not just the New York Daily News and that lengthy piece, but then it came out in, I think, Washington Post and New York Times too, that he'd been using a black cube.
Mm-hmm.
It was a former, so-called former Mossad, quote-unquote, former, quote-unquote, Mossad agency to track people who might tattletale on Harvey Weinstein.
Mm-hmm. Didn't they pose as activists and things like that?
And they did all kinds of things, like posing as feminists and, you know, messaging, getting hold of, I guess, Rose McGowan and other people too. But what else did I talk about? I'm going blank.
Well, you were talking. Well, one thing is you cite the Dutroux affair, and of course, and the people looking to that read Dave McGowan's book. And it,
right.
I think a good 30% of the book is on the Dutroux affair, if I recall reading it. There's a huge portion of it, and it just shows you sort of the high level. You mentioned the human trafficking, kidnappings, mm-hmm. Sort of the sex trafficking, serial killing, leading into this whole types of these predators are agents for very wealthy, powerful people.
They seem to get away with this for a very long time, and and be very well connected, right?
But the with the Hollywood, the Weinstein thing is, of course, the idea of the star. Was it Randy Quaid who claimed he was being harassed and targeted, and everyone thought he was nuts?
Right.
But this would seem to lend some credence to what he was saying back then, and how he can be targeted by certain agents and lawyers mm-hmm. and corporations to be, become a targeted individual, I guess, to be harassed and then ruined and have his money stolen from him.
Yeah, a lot of people made fun of the Star Whackers claim for a long time because they said, oh, Randy Quaid's just, he's on drugs and he's crazy. And I don't really know that much about Randy Quaid other than various movies he's been in. So I have no idea what his personal life is like. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying pro or con, but I'm saying that isn't it interesting that he said this stuff several years ago, and it was kind of a viral conspiracy video at one point. And then here we have mainstream news now coming out with a story that, oh, actually there are kind of star whackers in a way.
Mm-hmm. And he said this, there's sometimes the studio comes to the conclusion that a star is easier dead than alive. Mm-hmm.
Think of Brittany Murphy.
Yes. In the case of Brittany Murphy, where both her husband and her were poisoned, it turns out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, poison. Mm-hmm. They both got sick, but there was some sort of heavy metal poisoning or something. It was weird. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that factors into that case with that border guard, Davis. She's a witness in a case. A very odd case. Strange case.
It is very bizarre, right?
Yeah, if you get into that case. Judy, I think her name was Judy Davis or something. And her father was arrested. You know, they raided her house, and her husband was involved in movie production. And that somehow entangled Brittany Murphy and... that ultimately led to her demise and perhaps her husband's demise. In the video, you're going about Hollywood, and of course the role of Hollywood is played in large scale social engineering. And the whole idea of someone like the Weinstein scandal, I think, is itself, I think, a form of social engineering or social alchemy or something.
Yes, and I think that, you know, you were talking to Chris most recently. I heard that interview, and that came up. And I think you've mentioned, Wag the Dog a couple times in recent interviews, and the Lewinsky scandal, and how that kind of got everybody talking about something very degenerate. And I think that that's true. And you can't find, or I found a great example of that in the Heidi Fleiss case. Heidi Fleiss is basically saying that even she recognized that she was a cultural change agent. I don't know how cognizant of that she was in the 90s, but a more recent reflection that she had in that interview, she was saying, there's a direct connect from what was going on at that time in pop culture with Pretty Woman was out, which kind of had this glorification of prostitution.
Mm-hmm.
and Richard Gere and Julia Roberts, and Madonna was very popular at that time with all of her gross videos and whatnot. And then she said, then I was on the scene, and she said, I kind of invented the It Girl, and it went from me to Paris Hilton to Kim Kardashian.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that I kind of prepared the way for reality TV. And she said, if you remember at that time, there was Hard Copy and Inside Edition. And she said that these shows were, and she actually used some kind of, you know, some kind of phrase we would use, like, you know, like a global cultural change agent or some weird phrase she even used. So she seemed to be, you know, pretty cognizant of what was going on, at least nowadays.
Well, I mean, the whole thing of the creation of the cult of celebrity, I think, is there to some form of social, an agent for social alchemy. I think Bernays started the concept of the star with Enrico Caruso, the rock idol, or the celebrity culture. This started with the cinema, of course, and the successful construction of a movie theater in every town in America. And what that would have, the effect it would have on culture, you know, obviously, you know, the whole idea of what a movie star looks like, with the whole notions of beauty and expectation in life, and this coupled with increasing mobility, this would have a profound effect on American society. Once again, a sort of a destruction of local tradition and these things. But the scandal. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
This whole idea of celebrity scandal, right? Divorce, and the fact that people are obsessed with private celebrity lives, and of course Heidi Fleiss, we have the whole thing with this sordid sex life, and it begs the question, why is this even news, right?
Oh, she says, I normalize cheating.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so from the normalization of cheating, it just goes downhill even worse from there.
Yeah. And so now we have all this talk. I mean, we're getting into the sort of details of what Louis C.K. proposed to do in front of him in a hotel room. Now, why is this? I mean, from what I understand, there's no laws that are being violated here. It's just a, you know, rather strange proposal from a degenerate celebrity. And he just, even John Adams talks about this. He says how a lot of these cases are he said, she said, and men are just owning up to it. Yeah, I did it. I'm sorry. Blah, blah, blah.
You
know, I'm going to go get counseling now. When they could just say it's none of your business. What happened between, you know, really, you have right to say that. She may make that claim, but it really is none of your business. And then no one says that. When it's interesting enough, you mentioned, of course, the Pretty Woman. And I heard this on Ed Opperman, that the apartment in that movie was Elizabeth Short's apartment.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. When she comes down, you know, I think the end, I don't know if you saw Pretty Woman. Did you ever see Pretty Woman?
A long time ago, but I don't remember it. I think I was with a girlfriend or something who wanted to watch it.
And the end where Richard Gere comes and gets her to her apartment, she comes down the fire escape, if I recall. I'm trying to remember myself. I think it's late 80s, early 90s, maybe 1990. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was Elizabeth Short's apartment, from what I understand.
So that's bizarre.
Yeah. The Black Dahlia, as they say.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, this obsessed on Hollywood, and why, like I said, at any moment in history, you could focus on the casting couch and, Kenneth Anger wrote about this stuff in Hollywood Babylon.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. And another point, too, is that, had a point.
Well, I mean, a lot of the stuff is the blackmail, of course, the function that it serves. You mentioned also the DC Madam.
I read a long thing about Deborah Jean Palfrey and her whole story. And what was interesting was that there were 80 something escort services in DC at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually asked a good question. She said, why am I the focus of a giant investigation and news story?
Mm-hmm.
Now, yeah, I'm sure it had to do with, she had high profile people just like Heidi Fleiss did in her books or whatever, but that's probably just one level of it, because, you know, it's similar to the Fleiss story, because mm-hmm. Heidi Fleiss's clients, if I recall, were mainly Hollywood people.
Mm-hmm.
The DC Madam's clients are mainly government corporate people.
Yeah.
In other words, you have the erosion and the what's the word I'm looking for? The attempt to portray all aspects of society as
degenerate, corrupt.
Exactly. Yeah. And what that does is, in a way, it kind of fits into what H.G. Wells talked about, that the way to, we were not going to like completely tear down every existing institution. He says that's the naive Marxist view. He says what we need to do is infiltrate, subvert, and basically turn the institutions inside out from within.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're doing here is you're seeing the kind of not that American politicians were ever noble or great, but I think what we're seeing is that in each area of life, you kind of have a destruction of the institution to turn it inside out into a force for a coming technocracy that's even more powerful.
Yeah.
So like you were saying earlier, you know, it's not going to be all these different studios. You're going to have, you know, a few select mega corporate interests that will control entertainment. You'll have Disney and Netflix basically deciding entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And making, of course, making sure that people want to be constantly entertained, or you're not entertained. And that's how you get the cultural change. Because if first you need everyone to be obsessed with Hollywood to have the effect of a Hollywood scandal, right? I mean, everyone has
that's a good point. Yeah.
It's same thing with politics, too. It's sort of the mixing, the merging of Hollywood and politics, the whole Kevin Spacey thing, right? I mean, think about that.
House of Cards, right. Good point.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, and if you're watching even movies now, they bring in real news people to do. I mean,
see Wolf Blitzer on James Bond, right?
Yeah, I'm not kidding you. Sharknado 4 had Matt Lauer.
Wow.
So. Sharknado 4. So that not an A-list movie by any stretch of the imagination. Not a B movie. So I remember I saw this like in the 90s. Is that movie about with Robert Klein about the sort of like a play on the prince and the pauper, where he becomes president because he looks just like the president, and they started using real. Like news people.
You mentioned Dave?
Dave. So that was when I first started noticing
interesting.
In movies. Started the blurring
of reality. Fun, but I've forgotten that.
Yeah. No. The real news figures. And all, I mean, real media figures would be debating these things. And that's how the blending of reality and fiction. And, of course, so much of politics, so much of news is indeed fiction. So it's important. But I think it's good that we ended the interview talking about Hollywood. Because that's H.G. Wells would have considered entertainment. You know, obviously he wrote science fiction, right?
This is another point I want to make.
Yeah,
this is another point I want to make that is in my book, too, is a lot of people overlook the fact that, you know, we think of Hollywood as inculcating degeneracy and promoting, you know, sexual aberration and whatnot, which is all true. But we overlook the fact that all of these chapels in all the cities that you're talking about, called movie theaters, have also taught everyone for many, many, many decades Darwinism and scientism.
Yes.
Through H.G. Wells stories, through Star Trek, Star Wars, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep. And they've done it through entertainment. And that's where you get everyone's rapt attention, is through entertainment. And that's how most people see politics and history and understand the world is through the silver screen. And that's, you know.
Well, that's definitely one way to explain the success of Donald Trump is you have an entertainer who understands business, entertainment, and now I suppose politics.
Yeah.
Because they're not really different worlds, are they?
No, they're not.
I guess Nancy and Ron figured that out a long time ago after playing with that monkey in the Bedtime for Bonzo movie.
Yep, Bedtime for Bonzo, Ronald Reagan. The actor became the politician and governor than president, and that it is the same thing, you know. So anything else, Jay? I know you're kind of under the weather. I mean, any of the
points? No, I think that's all I've got tonight.
Okay, listen, I want to thank you for, you know, being a trooper. I know you're not feeling well and coming back on. That's great.
No problem.
Jay Dyer, Jay's Analysis, author of Esoteric Hollywood. You can subscribe to his website. That's $4.95 a month, $60 a year. And you get all his media and his analysis and these things. Also, Hollywood Decoded on the Guy Network.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you want to see a season two of that, go ahead and subscribe and share that with your friends, because that will determine whether there'll be a season two. Hoping there will be. We still still don't know yet. Also, I will. Oh, I remember what I was going to tell you at the beginning of the talk. I'm getting together the sequel to Esoteric Hollywood, which will be called Esoteric Hollywood the Sequel.
Okay. Yeah, so just when you thought it was safe to open a book, right?
Yeah, right.
The sequel.
So hopefully next year the sequel to Esoteric Hollywood will be out, and it'll be largely a lot of new material, whereas the first book was, you know, a lot of stuff that will, I think, hopefully be.
So
give it a bit of new material.
So this will probably be kind of easier to write because there's actually new material that you intend for a book. I know you had a lot of, when you were trying to get the book, converting
that's
articles.
That's true, yeah. Right.
So you can, actually this will be like you're writing for a book, so you can do it accordingly. So whatever. So maybe,
right.
Maybe perhaps it won't be quite as arduous. I don't know. I've never written
a book
before. So we'll
see.
Yeah. Okay, well, Jay, thanks a lot. That's Jay's Analysis, jaysanalysis.com. I'll let you go. I'll wish you, if I don't talk to you between now, of course, and the new year, a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Likewise, thank you.
Good luck then. Take it easy.
All right, have a good night.
Bye-bye.